Welcome to the Grin Gets Real podcast, the show for people who want to maximize their marketing potential. My name is Katya, and I'm your host on this exciting journey as we talk to the experts who join us. From influencer marketing to e-commerce strategy and everything in between, each episode has featured industry experts that share their insights and provide actionable tips to help you achieve your marketing goals. I have a special episode for you today as we end our first season of the podcast. Yep, folks, it has been a year and we've gone through so much together. And I'm not just talking about the obvious, the pandemic. Insert laugh track here. I'm talking about our guests across 24 plus episodes. We've had behavioral scientists, many authors of industry-changing books, CRO experts, video experts, influencer marketers, talent agents, and the list does go on. I am so thankful for everyone who has said yes, because these conversations have been some of my favorite moments of the year, excluding spending time with my family, but I'm sure that goes without saying. And honestly, I've learned so much. This episode is dedicated to all who came on the show and dropped their knowledge. My team here at Grin has handpicked the best of the best experts so you can relive these moments back with me and maybe even entice you to listen to more episodes. So put your AirPods in, turn up the volume, and get ready for the best of the best of season one of the Grin Gets Real podcast. Neil Schaefer is an authority on helping innovative businesses digitally transform their sales and marketing. Founder of the digital marketing consultancy PDCA Social, Neil also teaches at Rutgers Business School and the Irish Management Institute. Fluent in Japanese and Mandarin Chinese, Neil is a popular keynote speaker and has spoken on four continents and more than a dozen countries. He is also the author of four sales and marketing books, including Maximize Your Social and the recently published The Age of Influence, a groundbreaking book redefining digital influence, which is a must read. During this podcast, we chat about why your best influencer may be hiding in your customer list. So take a listen, episode 13 with Neil Schaefer. I think that you're right. For B2B, it is kind of untapped, right? It is your customers. I do want to touch on, because you articulate this so well in your book, about finding the right influencers. I think it's one of the biggest challenges that we run into. It's certainly one of like the top three, if not the top challenge for anybody who's engaging with or has an influencer marketing program. When you're looking for the right influencers, in your book, you dive into like these tiers that you attack first before diving into the unknown. Could you cover a little bit about like how to find that right influencer?
If you want people to talk about you in social, you want to collaborate with people that already know, like, and trust your brand. Because the level of influence necessary to be considered an influencer has become lower over time, you know, with a nano influencer, there's probably a lot of people that already know, like, and trust your brand that we would consider influential on a given social network. If you have distributors, resellers, I mean, it depends on your industry, but if there are marketing partners out there and they have influence in social media, or people that work for them do, it's also in their best interest that you succeed, and therefore you might be able to find people. But I think where it gets powerful is when you go to your customers.
Yes.
And it's funny, just, you know, my business banks with Bank of America. And just like last month, I got this, you're invited to the Bank of America Advisory Council. I'm like, huh, Bank of America doing influencer marketing. But then, and I don't want to bash Bank of America, but when I log in, it just wasn't engaging the way they had it structured. I can see that someone was happy that they had a lot of people joining it, but there was no incentive for me to log back in to this private form that they had created, or the questions they were asking, or anyway. So it's easy to invite customers into something, but it's a lot harder to actually activate them unless you treat them like an influencer. That same mindset when you wanted to reach out to that someone with a million or 2 million followers on TikTok or on Instagram, if you had that same mindset when you engage with your customers. And I'm not saying you need to engage with all of them. You know, there is technology that allows you to find social media profiles from an email address. And with a little, you know, data analysis, you can find the influencers among your customers. And you might be surprised. That same company that uses Grin, we used a tool to try to find influencers in their customer database. There were some verified profiles on Instagram with, you know, six-figure followers that were following. They were customers of the brand, and they didn't even realize it. And yeah. they were challenged to find influencers like many other companies. When you reach out to random people, you know, the law of average says only 3% are going to respond. And I think a lot of companies freak out when they send out 100 DMs and only 3 people respond. That's sort of the average in marketing. But when you reach out to people that are already your customers, obviously it's a whole different paradigm, right? They already use your product. They already love your product. They might already have pictures of using your product. They'd love to try out a new product. They'd love to help you. It just makes it a lot easier, and the end product is a lot better.
Kate Bradley Chernice is the founder and CEO of Lately, which uses AI to automatically transform long-form content like blogs, podcasts, and videos into dozens of smart social posts that yield the highest engagement from your audience. As a former marketing agency owner, Kate initially created the idea for Lately out of spreadsheets for a then-client Walmart and got them 130% ROI year over year for 3 years. Prior to founding Lately, Kate served 20 million listeners as music director and on-air host at Sirius XM. She also is an award-winning radio producer, engineer, and voice talent with 25 years of national broadcast communication, brand building, sales, and marketing expertise. We chat about how selling is always social. From her lips to your ears, she says, "So it's easy." And it's the same no matter what your industry is or how big or small your company is. And that is human connection. The number one cause for loss of sales is lack of customer trust, believe it or not. And trust comes from that connection. You like people, you believe them. So that's why people are like, "Oh, social selling, it's the new thing." Selling has always been social if you're any good at it. Enjoy episode 14, Kate Bradley Chernice. I'm really interested in just kind of understanding from your perspective, when it comes to social, what kind of content really resonates? Is it the type of content that you're pushing out, or is it how long that particular post is? What kind of trends have you seen in that?
So it's so easy, and it's the same no matter what your industry is or how big or small your company is. And that is human connection. The number one cause for loss of sales is lack of customer trust. Believe it or not, right? And trust comes from that connection. You like people, you believe them. So that's why, you know, people are like, "Oh, social selling, it's this new thing." And you're like, "Dude, selling has always been social if you're any good at it." It's just like a new mechanism. We're big fans, by the way, Katya, of humans and AI together. So not just the AI or automation on its own, right? Yeah. So we insist that the customer enhances the AI with their human voice. The reason we do that is twofold. Number one, the AI will start to learn better what you sound like and what's good and resonates with your audience. But number two, that's the magical equation. We've learned that AI on its own is fine. Humans on their own, fine. But AI plus humans, that's like 1 + 1 = 3. And that's what you want, right? You want the home run.
You said something, you know, at the top of our conversation, turning listeners into fans. Tell me a little bit about what you found in that. Is it just the social connection? What is it that made you find the listeners into fans? Like, what was that secret sauce of creating them into fans?
So I was really lucky to do mostly live radio for the first 10 years of my career. And then at XM, for example, it was all recorded, but we wanted to make it sound live. So we would leave in mistakes, or I learned silence is very powerful, right? Because what do listeners do? They lean in, they turn it up. And then I learned little techniques about my listeners. Primarily, they were a mix of men and women, and mostly 50-50. And one weird thing that I learned was my radio voice, Katya, is a little bit different than my regular voice. I learned to smooth it out. It comes down to making you trust me. And then the second part, not to be forgotten about, is getting attention, right? So whoever you know, shouts the loudest, that is a thing, right? So what there's how you're saying it. We talk a lot about how to say it, how to write it. And then of course the what you're writing, which we can get into that too if you want.
I do want to get into the writing, but when I hear what you're saying, you know, there are a couple things. It's how to translate that what you're describing from an audio to like the actual written word. But I think also with social, it's more than just writing on the post or the post writing, right? Like you to me, from a content perspective, it's also like the visual that you're pushing out. So my question to you is there a combination or a sweet spot between, like, let's say it's a video that has an audio that you're looking at the caption, right? Like, is there a sweet spot in combining all three of those things so that you hit on that emotion that you're talking about to kind of build on that trust?
While visual, of course, is powerful, you want, just like a good slide presentation, you want the visual to complement and fill in the blanks rather than mirror the conversation. I think a lot about Gary Vee back in the old days of South by Southwest. So I used to go to South by Southwest when it was much smaller and you could literally bounce from room to room when interactive. I was like there first through 6 years of interactive. And one thing that had happened then was Twitter was just launched, right? And there was this weird third person in the room. And so you'd have people on stage with the screen and the Twitter feed going and the whole audience participating there, but also participating in the audience at the same time. And Gary Vee then and now, if you see him on TikTok, is amazing at pulling that third voice in the room, right? He makes you feel it. Even though you're watching and listening, you're part of the conversation. And so when we do our webinars, I do the same thing. Like the first thing I do is ask where everybody's from, put it in the chat. What's the weather? Like all those things. And I call them out like, oh, what's up, Palo Alto? Great to see you, Cammie. You know, all these kinds of things, right? So it's figuring out how to use that media in a way that is like, I guess, a trifecta.
Shireen Orezi is the founder and president of Next Stepped, an award-winning behavioral marketing agency with offices in San Francisco and Boston. She has a degree in engineering and computer science from UC Berkeley and holds accreditations from Duke University and UC Berkeley on behavioral science and positive psychology. Her work applying behavioral science and marketing is regularly featured on Forbes, Inc., and Huffington Post. She's on the board of Entrepreneurs Organization and a guest lecturer at Stanford. So excited to talk to her. And during our chat, we really dive into the behavioral science principles that every marketer needs to know. Enjoy episode 15 with Shireen Orezi.
Now, I do want to go back to one of the things that you had mentioned previously, which is social proof. And I think that's a really great tie-in when it comes to influencer marketing. Break it down. What is social proof? What is it that we mean by that? And how is that connected to influencers?
Yeah. So social proof is this idea that as humans, we're basically pretty motivated by how others are behaving or acting. And just to kind of help visualize it in your brain, think of it, if you were going to go to a restaurant and there were two restaurants side by side on your block, one has a big long line outside of it, the other one, there's not a single person outside the restaurant, I should say now, but because of COVID, because nobody's inside the restaurant, then you're most likely to go stand in line. So that's a perfect example of you being motivated by social proof, what other people are doing, because you have no idea technically if the food in one is better than the other. You're literally judging based on what other people standing in line are doing. So there's actually different types of social proof that motivates humans. There's peer social proof, which is this idea that people that are closest to me in terms of circumstance and condition. So think of it this way. If you were going to go, find a new, say, dermatologist or somebody to do your will or whatnot, you're more likely to go to your peers, to your friends, to people that are the most similar to ask for advice. And so we typically see a lot of like peer social proof in marketing in general. So it's basically testimonials and all that good stuff from people the most similar to our audience. Then you have expert social proof. And the idea with expert social proof is people that I want to be. They're not my peers, but I aspire to be. And I think, for example, what Grin does and like a lot of the foundation of what you guys do with influencers, that's a perfect example of leveraging expert social proof, because these are influencers, they have a lot of followers, it's possible somebody that I want to potentially aspire to. If you look at, you know, all the sports ads, et cetera, that, you know, feature the athletes, et cetera, these are all perfect examples of expert social proof. And then another type of social proof is called number social proof. And this is the idea that I'm going to just show you that there's a sheer number of people doing this. So think of McDonald's, billions and billions of people served, et cetera. And so a lot of times when you are in a situation where you can't use peer social proof or expert social proof, you just want to show that, hey, there's a lot of people doing this and therefore you should do it. And then finally, there's a type of social proof that you definitely don't want to be using, which is called negative social proof. And what not to do exactly. So this is the inadvertently one. So like, let's say in an e-commerce site, like for example, Amazon obviously does a really good job with all their reviews that they do. Now, negative social proof is like if you come and you put like the ability for people to do reviews on your site, but then you have like one or two reviews that are, you know, potentially negative or not a lot. So it's actually literally hurting your cause because it's showing that there aren't a lot of people like me doing this.
Rehan Pereira is CEO and founder of OneDash, a platform that offers the tools to make any kind of media interactive, helping brands make an instant return on their content investments. A serial entrepreneur, Rehan has expertise in venture capital, e-commerce strategies, and digital marketing. During our chat, we dive into video and discuss how it's dominating in marketing, along with how you can leverage video as a marketer. Enjoy episode 17 with Rehan Pereira.
I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on the length of a video. So let's just say it's a standard video.
Yeah.
What do you constitute as long form? And I'm using my quotation marks because I feel like anytime you Google something like that, it's anywhere from like 1 minute to 20 minutes. I mean, that's a really broad stroke. So I'm curious, based on like just kind of what you've seen come across, is there a sweet spot for a video length, or is it more about the content of that video and the purpose of it?
Yeah, we've noticed some interesting stuff when it comes to the analytics that we see. A couple of interesting examples would be we take a fashion-related example. If you've got a video where you're trying to showcase more than 2-3 products at the same time. Mm-hmm. One thing that we've noticed is from the time that you introduce the largest form product, let's say it's a dress, from the time that somebody sees that product to the time that they want to interact with that product or basically click on that product and get more information or buy that product, we see anywhere between 3 and 7 seconds being the sweet spot there, where people will really take the time to discover this product. And the brain registers, okay, there's something else going on here. We want to take a look at this. I'm interested. In terms of going into then looking at other products within the offering and going deeper into that, anywhere up to 25 seconds for a video is usually perfect, you know, nothing more than that. So if you're talking about something that you're, you know, delivering on stories or something that you're delivering on social media, that you're able to kind of break the attention span by giving them more information, by giving them an activity to do, 25 seconds is good. If it's just a video without any interaction rates or anything to do there, less than that.
Sure.
The attention span doesn't go very long because as soon as they see something, they know whether they want to explore that more or not. So, you need to send that message in less than 20 seconds, definitely, if you're talking about that. Now, if it's experiential stuff, food, if you're talking about travel, if you're talking about hotels, et cetera, luxury industry, or something that's just breaking, something new, something that they've never seen before, you're going over. You they want to feed off that information. They want more. You're looking at more like a minute. I'd never go more than that. I've never seen videos that go more than a minute do very well on social media at all. So, you know, IGTV and stuff is good if that is what I'm in the mood for and that's what I'm there for, absolutely.
Yeah.
I need to be there for that. But if I'm you know, cruising through social media and there's something that grabs my eye and it takes me more than a minute to get the information that I want, not happen. So that's what we've noticed a lot. And it also depends on what the product is or what the message is or what the service is that you're going for.
A British designer by trade, Bonjoura is Matt Barnett's second company, founded out of Sydney, Australia. What started as a sales hack for an agency he was running, Bonjoura went from hack to side hustle to global business in 18 months, and now has a team across 5 continents. Matt's love of building great products is only surpassed by that of building great culture, and his goal is to be the next Zappos and the most loved brand in the world. When not head down in product, Matt spends his time rescuing wildlife, teaching his daughter about beekeeping, and running one of Sydney's largest tech founder networks. During our chat, we discuss linking attribution to word of mouth, how using video in sales can help build trust, and the impact of the lifetime value for brand success. Enjoy episode 18 with Matt Barnett.
What's your take on influencer marketing and authenticity and, you know?
Yeah, so a lot of our growth has been through influencers. So we invest a lot in customer success heavily because we use it as a growth lever. And so that what it's given us is it's given us customers and super fans who love us and talk about us, and we end up going on webinars and podcasts and we do content together. You know, with us, it wouldn't work if they weren't already customers and didn't we love not just the product, but the brand and kind of the team. So we try and get that passion in because that's what converts. Again, we would never, you don't pay for people who are just going to spout your name even if they don't believe in what you do, because people will see through it. I think there's been a shift in, I guess, consumer attitudes over the last few years, especially in kind of like driven by the corporate side of town, which is that I think people are over the BS. I think they're starting to spot the kind of fake attitudes. They're starting to spot the tricks. They're starting to get fed up of it. Like our inboxes are full of, my inbox is full of trash like every day. And and we've hit like a tipping point where suddenly those brands that are like, again, you hate all of the word, but like are actually authentic and that are human and that are just coming at you as they are. It's actually pretty refreshing. And it's leading to those brands growing faster. I mean, Slack's a good example. Yeah. That one move they had a while ago, which was if you remove a team member, they refund you like straight away. Don't ask any questions, give it back. Suddenly everyone was like, oh, this is a different attitude. This is very authentic. Although it wasn't on the personal front, somebody made that decision and the culture made that decision that if someone's not using us, give the money back, refund, don't worry about it. That's generated so much goodwill and you can kind of see it on other points of their culture. So again, I think consumers have hit a breaking point. I think you have to be transparent and be yourself because like the old school way, the barriers are coming down.
Derek Haney is the host of the Future of E-Commerce podcast and chief e-commerce technologist at E-Commerce Tech IO, where e-commerce stores go to research, discover, and buy the right tools to grow their store. Half of his day is spent reviewing tech tools, and the other half is talking with merchants to help them discover which solutions are right for them. When he's not doing that, you can find him speaking, networking, or grabbing a drink at any of your favorite e-commerce events. One of my favorite humans, we could talk for hours, but during this chat about how to choose the right e-commerce tool for your brand, we get to discover a peek into the methodology behind it, how to get buy-in on that new technology, and so much more. Enjoy episode 19 with Derek Haney.
Are there technology tools that are out there right now that you're excited about for e-commerce?
Yeah, there's some really amazing emerging product categories. One that I'm really bullish on, but also based on my experience in human behavior, I expect a really slow adoption rate, which I think, so if you're listening to this, maybe you have a larger opportunity than a lot of other people because it's totally practical and affordable today, but I don't think people really give it the time of thought, which is a price testing tool. So there is a really cool company called PriceStack that seems to have cracked this. There are others that exist, but you just install the tool to your Shopify store. It looks at your history of discounts and prices on your products, and it literally uses the fundamentals of economics, supply demand curves and all sorts of things to tell you what your most likely best price is. Then you can just one click change the price of your products, and then it will learn from there and continue to look at data, including your conversion rate and visitor and conversion rate information, right?
Yeah.
And then I think eventually where they're heading is they're going to also understand competitive dynamics to see what else is going out on the internet in order to do that. And they did a test with one merchant who was selling, they're called walkie paws, and it's like the only leggings for dogs. And they were selling them for $34.99, installed the tool, and basically proved in a few minutes, like maybe up to an hour of crunching numbers automatically behind the scenes, that a better price would be $39.99. It would have very little impact on lowering conversion rate, because that's the main concern, right? As I'm going to lose customers. The impact was almost negligible, but it would increase profitability by a significant margin. And so I was like, holy crap. Like in just like 5 minutes, basically, you uncovered a pricing error that when you're selling tens of thousands of a product, that's a lot of money that was left on the table that you were totally oblivious to until you found this little hack, essentially.
Claire Leon is co-founder at Acorn I, where she is responsible for overseeing internal teams, working closely with partners, and driving the company's expansion in market. She previously spent 7 years at Amazon, where she had a key role in bringing its advertising platform to market in the UK and building partnerships with agencies at a global level. During our chat, we break down what omnichannel is and why it's important for any brand to be successful. Enjoy episode 20 with Claire Leon.
The challenge of being so data-centric is not under, you know, a brand or store not really understanding what to do with the data. Do you ever find that there's a little bit of data overload? Like, that's great. I have all of these data points, but I only understand 5. What do you do, or how, and especially at Acorn AI, how do you make it tangible for brands to understand the most important data points to help inform their strategy?
Yeah, so I think it's a really great point that you're saying there. I think that is part of the problem. Like, if you go in, you log in to an Amazon Render Central account or an Amazon Seller Central account. Uh-huh. It's a world in itself. I mean, there is just so much there. Yeah. It is, and not only is there data overload, but it is so time consuming.
Yeah.
And the resource that is for brands is really sizable. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you would need to kind of, without having a solution that makes that easy, you're going to have to log in to multiple single dashboards, export different reports, stitch them together, pull all of that, then understand what are the optimizations I'm therefore going to make on my business. Do I need to do more influencer marketing? Do I need to do more promos? Do I need to do, you know, all of this stuff? That is so inefficient for brands. So what ends up happening is they go, oh, that is just too difficult. But what they're ignoring by doing that is that if you could get that data in a really easy and succinct way, and you combine that data with your own website data and your advertising pools, you start to understand the shopper engagement so much better.
From talent management to an obsession with technology and a knack for negotiations, Jesse Grossman's work has led to the creation of new opportunities for hundreds of influencers and brands. Jesse is a longtime entrepreneur in the entertainment and digital media space. She's been quoted in Forbes and was awarded a spot in the Influencer Top 50 by Talking Influence in 2020. In less than 2 years, she created one of the fastest growing new talent agencies in the country. Amidst unprecedented growth, the agency was sold in early 2020, and she pivoted to focus on her longtime passion project, Women in Influencer Marketing. Now, during this episode, Jesse and I geek out over influencer marketing, and she provides the inside scoop on talent management. From her mouth to your ears, she says, the most successful influencers that I've worked with, it was a true partnership, meaning that they were hustling so hard, just as we are on our end. Enjoy episode 21 with Jesse Grossman.
Let's get a cheat sheet from the influencer perspective. So if you are a talent manager and you could give like the top three, five tips, or however many you can list off for an influencer that is going to approach you, what would you want to tell them?
Okay. So these are influencers who are looking for management. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So number one is treating your, like presenting your business, right? Like this is your opportunity to share how you have monetized your business. Managers are, you know, not working on retainer. Managers only make money when you make money. So if you are approaching a talent manager and looking for representation, the number one thing that they're going to be most interested in is how have you made money thus far? Where do your relationships lie? How successful have your partnerships been? Ideally, it's not just that you're working with a million different brands. It's that you're having long-term relationships with people who come back and want to work with you again. I cannot emphasize that enough, because sharing that and having that be your MO will go such a long way, because then that manager can say, oh, thank goodness, like I can pitch this person to somebody and know that they're going to be on time. They're going to deliver the great content. They're going to get great engagement. They're going to be great salespeople, because at the end of the day, like you're selling products or you're selling something. And so you need to have a history, a job history, right? A work history of success. And so, you know, sharing that, whether it's in a conversation, make it visual, make it beautiful, like share some screenshots, you know, really like have your portfolio there and ready. So that's one thing. I appreciate influencers who ask a lot of questions, because again, this is a long-term business relationship that we're getting into. So, you know, you might be an incredible influencer, but you might just not be the best fit for the business that I'm tapped into. And that's okay. And if that's the case, I'm going to refer you to one of my friends who is a manager at another agency who just might be tapped into that business. And like, that's okay. And then the last thing I'd probably say is probably to do your homework on that agency or that agent and talk about like, hey, I know that you guys work with this company and I've worked with them before. And then that'll be a reference of sorts, right? Uh-huh. Those are just a few things that I would tell influencers to prepare.
Carrie Melissa Jones is an author, community builder, and researcher of online communities. Her work has influenced the world's leading online brand communities, including the American Medical Association, Patreon, Google, and two U.S. presidential campaigns. She is the author of Building Brand Communities, How Organizations Succeed by Creating Belonging with Charles Vogel, and a student teacher and researcher of virtual communities at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Prior to her work as a consultant, she served as founding partner and COO of CMX, the hub for over 20,000 community professionals worldwide. Not only am I a huge fan of her book, but also in the way she speaks about community. She says, a community is a group of people who share a mutual concern, period. They have to actually care about one another in order to be considered a community. And during this episode, we really dig into how we can create that level of engagement needed to build a strong community. Enjoy episode 22 with Carrie Melissa Jones.
So community, I think, is incredibly important. And like we had already talked about, it is becoming a little bit of a buzzword, but I think it's really important to find people that really identify with you as a brand, speaking from a brand perspective. How serious do you think brands should take building a brand community? Do you think that they're missing the boat if they don't invest in really building out a community for their business?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I obviously believe that like all organizations should care and be community-led organizations. But the reality is that there are some organizations in which the leadership or sometimes the individual contributors are not ready to be changed by what a community will show them, will teach them. So what they really want is people to just do what they say. And hopefully, in some cases, yeah. What I see a lot is hope that they can reduce spending on customer service, for instance. So they'll start a brand community that is kind of a Q&A site where really excited customers can help other customers. They're not really willing to listen, though, to those people. They just want them to kind of take work off of their plate, but they don't want to be transformed by what those people might teach them. And so I see a lot of those efforts fail. A lot of trust is broken. I think it's almost more harmful to launch something like that and then ignore or manipulate and extract from people than it is to just keep going business as usual. So I would say organizations are missing out 100%. I guarantee it. If they are not building some kind of community, that could be internal to their team, their organization needing a community. Yeah. It could be, their partners, their vendors, their customers, their prospects. There's a million ways you could build community in your organization. If you're not doing that, you're missing out on knowledge, basically, is what you're missing. And leadership has to be ready to recognize that as knowledge in order for it to be successful.
Josh Rausch is the CEO and lead brand strategist at Movetic, an award-winning branding agency located in Leucadia, California. Now, since the age of 19, Josh worked with brands such as HP, Lyft, Crocs, Reef, Verizon, The Dew Tour, Hilton, Celsius, YMCA, Sunbum, really the list goes on. Fueled by stay moving lifestyle, he leverages the power of creativity and analytics to create experiences that are real, relevant, and above all else, memorable using photography, design, and technology. So much fun chatting with Josh. And during our conversation, we go over what questions you have to answer to uncover your brand story, how to use that story for design strategically, and getting influencers to tell your brand story, and so much more. Enjoy episode 23 with Josh Rausch.
One of the biggest pain points that people have is finding the right influencer. But if you know who you are and you know what you're looking for, like you can be strategic, you can be exclusive. You can say like, hey, I know you have a lot of followers, but I'm looking for someone who loves my brand because that person is going to share the story. What are your thoughts on using that to find the right influencers to represent your brand?
I mean, that's everything, right? Because at the end of the day, you're tapping into the emotional side of somebody's brain.
Yeah.
It's not just so contractual. A good example is we worked with Celsius and in 2019, we traveled around the US shooting with over 100 plus different influencers. And I kid you not, we had everybody contracted to do X, Y, and Z. They had to do, right, your cliche, I need two stories, I need one post feed. But like the biggest thing that every brand negates is that we're all human. We were able to develop a relationship with these individuals and like we became a part of their community. And in turn, they became a part of our community. They let us into their circle. Therefore, we get to be let into theirs. It's just this triage of like working together in harmony. Then from there, I mean, talk about the ROI, right? Like because they liked us and because we were on the same level, playing field hypothetically in that regard. I mean, they did 3-4 times what they were contracted to do. Right. And talk about ROI, talk about impressions, like what is the value you put on a really good relationship with somebody? And everybody would have looked at them and said, oh, they have 5,000 followers. Cool. They're tiny. They don't have much lift or whatever. But like, arguably, they know and they run these towns. And just because they don't have a lot of social clout doesn't mean like that they don't make a lot of impact. Right. That's why everybody's going towards the micro and nanos. It's just way more effective because they don't have followers that don't necessarily align with their brand. And I think, Instagram is a very good testament of that. It's just, it got so saturated And now the smart brands are like, no, I want to go after the people that know who they are, which in turn, they know their audience, which in turn, they have a higher conversion rate. They have a lot of comments. They have a lot of DMs. Like anything they say, their whole network is just like, yep, I'll buy it right now. Cool. I'm in. Sold. You don't even have to sell me because it's part of their lifestyle. Like that's what you want, right? Like you don't want to, you know, there's the influencers that I swear to God, like, oh, this CBD brand, this CBD brand. Oh, this is the new brand. Oh, here's this brand. It's like over and over and over again. And like time and time again, you're going to see right through it.
Justin Moore is the founder of Creator Wizard, an online resource where he teaches the business of being an influencer. Along with his wife, April, he has been a full-time creator for over 7 years on social media for 10 plus years and has personally made over $3 million working with brands. He has also run an influencer marketing agency for over 5 years that has helped other creators earn an additional $2 million. He has worked on more than 500 brand deals, interpreted 1,000 plus sponsorship contracts, and has partnered with pretty much every consumer brand imaginable. He has a unique perspective because not only has he been a creator in the trenches doing brand deals for years, but by running an agency, he has been in the room with countless brands, helping them decide how to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on influencer campaigns. Justin needs no introduction, as he is a very successful influencer and creator. We dive into influencer creator as a business. So many great tips for creators and brands alike. Justin has so much to share. So enjoy episode 24 with Justin Moore.
I do have another question, though, in regards to just kind of content creation. One of the things that we tend to run into a lot is like, okay, whether it's paid or product seeding, I'm not getting the right content that I want in order to be repurposed, right? Because from a brand perspective, there is so much ROI from influencer marketing is being able to repurpose across other marketing strategies. But what kind of advice can you give to a brand who's kind of struggling to get that right content from the creator, right? Because you want to give them their creative space, but you also want to get what you want to get.
My advice about this is try to involve the creators earlier on in the campaign planning process.
Okay.
So rather than fully baking the brief, right, around how you want the campaign to be executed, why not reach out to a few creators that you think would be a good fit and then ask them how they would bring it to life, right? Oh. I mean, maybe there's a trend on TikTok that would be perfect that you don't know about, right? Or maybe there is a certain hashtag trending on Instagram that you can take advantage of. As a brand, you literally cannot possibly keep track of everything on social media, right? Of like everything that's working. So you really should try to lean on creators. And again, try to compensate like some creators for this type of market research. This isn't something, you know, you're going to like email, like ask for a bunch, an hour of a creator's time just to like pick their brain. No, like allocate a budget, allocate, you know, a couple thousand dollars or whatever, and basically create kind of like a creator advisory board, because creators have their fingers on the pulse of like what's working on social media, because they're doing it day in and day out, right? So it's unrealistic as a brand to think that you can parachute in once every quarter and like run a campaign and make sure that it's timely and relevant in that cultural moment, right? So you really do need to have a faster cycle time of like how often you're monitoring what's going on social media to ensure that when this campaign actually launches, that it's relevant.
Anthony Blattner is a tech entrepreneur and ex-IBMer, now the founder of Speedworks Social, a LinkedIn advertising agency. After watching many startups fail, even after launching an amazing product or service, Anthony decided to do something about it. In nearly every case, he observed that quality marketing made the biggest difference between growth and decline. Anthony launched Speedworks in 2016 to help build B2B companies unlock their marketing potential. By blending his experience in technology with marketing, he's been able to help businesses reach key decision makers consistently and at scale using LinkedIn ads. During our chat, he breaks down LinkedIn marketing from ways to gain post engagement to common pitfalls. If you want to learn more about all things LinkedIn, then this is the episode for you. Enjoy episode 25 with Anthony Blattner.
I'd love to hear from your side, just kind of common misconceptions that you see people have when it comes to just kind of any paid advertising strategy to begin with.
Yeah. So the two things that I'd say are the biggest pitfalls that I see is, first is with LinkedIn, people assume it's too expensive. And I will first say LinkedIn is a much more expensive channel, but for the right company, it makes sense. So if you are a high ticket type of offer that you're selling and you need to target a niche decision maker at scale, that's where LinkedIn is going to be the best for you. So if you're looking to target finance directors at law firms of a certain size, LinkedIn's the place to go for that. Whereas like that's going to be finding a needle in the haystack on Facebook. It's more expensive, but when you need that type of granularity, that's where it's useful. And then number two is, I'd say going too direct for the book an appointment, get a free consultation type of offering your campaigns. For most companies, advertising, it's probably the first time that the viewer has ever heard about you. So we recommend being more educational with your content and offering what we call lead magnets and starting your campaign that way.
Okay, so let's talk about LinkedIn is too expensive. I've actually said that line myself, so I completely understand why it would be a potential misconception. And I hear what you're saying about really making it something of value, but how can you invest into LinkedIn while still investing into other paid media strategies as well? And where in the marketing funnel do you place LinkedIn advertising? Is that a top of the funnel and awareness stage? Or are we going a little bit more middle of the funnel when it comes to LinkedIn advertising?
For a B2B company that needs to target a niche decision maker, so when you want to find somebody who's very specific, LinkedIn is great for being able to acquire that traffic. So we usually stick to top of funnel for LinkedIn. And it's because on other channels, it's just hard to find that target person on these other channels.
Yeah.
Whereas like on Facebook, you know, if we say like the finance director at law firms example, it's just going to be hard to find them on Facebook. So you have to start on LinkedIn to find those people. And then, you know, that's where they start clicking through to your site or they start signing up for your lead magnets and become aware of you there. And then once they have become a lead, then you can follow up with them via cheaper means. So once you've captured the lead or once they've been to your site, then you can retarget them with like Facebook ads or Google ads, and then you can send them emails and call them and follow up from there.
Allison Brown has been a leader in influencer marketing since 2016 when she spearheaded the program at Kodiak Cakes, a health foods company. At Kodiak Cakes, she uniquely created a program that used experiential events across the country to build relationships and brand awareness. Allison then moved to Factor, where she created another high-achieving influencer marketing program. Allison combined influencer marketing and social media efforts as a director of both departments at her last role, seeing the benefits of having both run in tandem to achieve the same goals. I had so much fun chatting with Allison about what happens after you've started running your influencer program. So many people want to learn how to get started, but she's been there and done that and knows how to take a program to the next level. Enjoy episode 26 with Allison Brown. Because you have also been a part of, you know, kind of developing programs from the ground up with startups, what do you think people kind of have to have in place before even getting started with an influencer marketing program?
I think having a clear goal is huge. Uh-huh. Making sure everyone on the marketing team, especially the higher ups, are aligned with what the goal for the program is. I think it's a huge red flag when you go start influencer marketing and they want it all. They want high conversions. They want the biggest numbers of brand awareness, and they want a ton of content creation that they can reuse. I think when you try and go into influencer marketing and have all of those things as your goals, you're probably not going to do any of those things well. So if you can really narrow it down to just one thing to focus on, you can do that one thing very well and really succeed. But if you're constantly trying to figure out a sweet spot for all three or more of those goals, it's just not going to work. And then beyond that, I think you need a good people infrastructure to run the influencer marketing program and the technology to run it. I think gone are the ways of using Excel spreadsheets to manage this kind of thing.
You don't like all the formulas and trying to remember which cell you updated last time. I always feel like that's been my struggle always with spreadsheets and even in running influencer programs, just kind of in the past. So that's kind of your advice for getting started. Let's say I'm already started and now I'm like, I want to scale. And scale for me means I'd like to double whatever the amount of influencers I have. I personally think it's unrealistic to say, all right, I want 50 to 1,000. Like, I feel like you got to crawl before you walk and walk before you run, right? But what kind of things do you think a program kind of has to have in place before you can really tackle that scaling? If I'm working from a spreadsheet, because I can manage 25 influencers on a spreadsheet, but I do see like doubling, tripling in the future, what kind of things do I need to have in place in order to make that happen?
You absolutely need a platform. I like, cannot stress that enough. And, you know, Grin is obviously my platform of choice after doing so many demos with different platforms and even working with so many different options. Grin, you know, has it all in terms of if you're just looking to generate content and kind of categorize it and look through the content that people are creating, or if you really want to measure click-through rates and ROI and conversions, Grin can do all of those things. And I think deciding that you're going to scale is step one. Step two is immediately go purchase a platform.
Yeah.
It's usually a pretty big investment, especially for small companies, but I think that that's the biggest piece of advice I can give is just know that you're reinvesting in yourself when you sign up for a platform to actually track everything on, because at that point, you're not spending so many man hours doing something that a program can do for you. You don't have to manually go in and look at stories and, you know, look at how many likes and comments a post got. It's so unnecessary and it's such a waste of time. You know, when you have one person running an entire program, you can't expect them to do that.
Joe Polizzi is the Amazon bestselling author of Content Inc., Killing Marketing, and Epic Content Marketing, which was named the must-read business book by Fortune magazine. His novel, The Will to Die, was awarded Best Suspense Book of 2020 by the National Indie Excellence Awards. And Joe's latest version of Content Inc. has been released this year in May. He has founded four companies, including digital content news site, The Tilt, as well as Content Marketing Institute. In 2014, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Content Council. His podcast series, This Old Marketing with Robert Rose, has millions of downloads across more than 150 countries. His foundation, The Orange Effect, delivers speech therapy and technology services for children in over 35 states. That is quite a CV. My spirit animal in content marketing, the godfather of content marketing. This was a dream interview. A fan of his books and podcasts, this was all about me geeking out about content marketing. Finding your content tilt to proving content ROI and so much more. Enjoy episode 27 with Joe Polizzi. I like the idea of internal marketing because I do have a question that I had wanted to ask you on like really how you sell it to the boss, because without the quantitative, hey, this content asset got you this amount of sales. Without that information, it's tough to really hone in on like, yes, we need more white papers because people who come in who read this white paper are more likely to become our customers. Now, without that number behind it, how do you sell it to the boss? How do you like promote like, hey, this is going to get us this? Is it the mission statement?
No, I'll give you a tangible example because I had to sell it when I first started at Penton Media, this large B2B publishing company. I ran the custom media division. So we were selling content marketing services and I got wind that we were on the chopping block. We were going to get cut all together. We had 50 plus people part of this department, and we actually were doing fairly well. But the company was going through rough times, and I realized that the people that were making these decisions had no clue who I was, who we were as an organization, or what we did. So basically every week, and at the time, this is how old I am, we did inter-office memos. So I did the yellow envelope, and I sent them out to all the publishers and all the executive team every week. And I wrote down, here's what's going on. Here's what some of our customers are dealing with, our advertisers are dealing with, and here's how we're solving some of these, or here's what our competition is doing over here. And every week it was an educational piece on what content marketing was, why we do it as a company, and why it's important to our future. And lucky enough, I started getting calls from publishers that said, oh, you know, can you come on my next sales call? Or one of the executives that had hated us said, why can't we sell advertising? Like, what are we doing creating magazines for other people? Actually said, oh my God, can you do a presentation for my team? And that happened over time. So yeah. I did that program a long, long time, probably about 6 to 9 months. And then it really started to take off, but we didn't get cut. And believe it or not, today, that department is still thriving and doing really, really well. Same thing. Do your content marketing program, but do it internally. What's my business challenge? What am I trying to do? What do I want? How do I want the behavior to change internally? What could this be? A lot of times I know Xerox does an email to their sales key salespeople. That's worked for them internally. It could be an internal only podcast where you give them 5 minutes, 10 minutes a week on what's going on and why you're doing some things, or how do you share that with the marketing team? I don't know. Figure out what makes the most sense and you can do, and you have the time to do something really, really good. But we content marketing has been around hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But still, it's a new muscle in most organizations. So you have to pave the way for success. So you have to communicate your way there.
Kathleen Booth is the Vice President of Marketing at Clean.io and a startup marketing expert. She is also the host of the Inbound Success podcast and a board-level advisor for tech startups. Her marketing security career includes government and public sector consulting on strategic communications, as well as co-founding a marketing agency with her husband. Now, Kathleen advocates for digital engagement and marketing security. She also dedicates much of her time to guiding startups to help them meet the evolving demands of the 21st century digital retail. Such an interesting conversation with Kathleen about promo codes. Sounds simple, but there is so much more to it. During this episode, we talk about the solutions that you need to add to your security tech stack, malvertisements, this one was a new one for me, and a behind-the-scenes look at deal sites and coupon extensions. Enjoy episode 28 with Kathleen Booth.
Today, we're going to talk about promo codes, coupon codes. It's called various things. But what I found so interesting in speaking to you beforehand was the education on security as it comes in the digital space. I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on why marketers should educate themselves on digital engagement security. I feel like it's obvious, but it's not really that obvious either.
You know, it's really interesting because I've been in the marketing business for a long time. I'm not going to say how long, but it's been a while. And when I went to school for marketing, and I don't think this has changed, you know, we weren't taught about security. It's not something that was seen as a marketer's concern. And as marketing has become more and more digital, marketers have taken on large IT budgets. In fact, there's a lot of data that shows that now we have bigger IT budgets than the IT leader in the company does. And so, so much of our marketing is online, you know, whether that's on other platforms like social media or on our own website, which, you know, we as marketers are always taught to think of our own website as our owned asset, right? You have control over your website. And interestingly, that's a big misnomer. And that's where digital engagement security really comes in, is that traditionally before digital, when you were looking to build trust with your audience, and let's face it, we're all in the same business, right? We're all selling trust, regardless of whether we sell marketing services or sneakers or tractors or, you know, artificial intelligence. It's all trust. And so traditionally, when we wanted to build trust with our audience, we did that through the experience we delivered in our office, in our store, when we met with people. There was more human interaction. And that's really been replaced by digital interactions or engagements, as we call them now. And so the real starting point for building trust in a digital world is protecting those digital engagements and giving your users, your customers, your audience, your prospects a trustworthy way to engage with you online. And so that's really, that's what digital engagement security is all about. Unfortunately, the gap is that marketers haven't been taught about any of it. And so we've been thrust into the situation where we're responsible for it, but we don't have the tools to manage it. And so I'm very passionate about this because I do think it's something that marketers need to learn more about because we have such control over it. And if you don't get it right, what's at stake is your company's brand reputation, the user experience you're delivering, and honestly, revenue. And those three things are central to our ability to succeed as marketers.
David Wax isn't just the founder of Handwritten. He is also a marketing expert and a serial entrepreneur who understands personalized retail and relationship management. In this exclusive podcast interview, David goes into detail about how a personal touch can deepen your relationship with customers. It's as simple as a handwritten note. Do you have one from a business that you've kept? During this episode, we really dive into personalization and how to scale personalization as you grow. Enjoy episode 29 with David Wax.
I too save anything handwritten. Mm-hmm. One, I don't normally go through the mail. You know, I think that there was a point in time where we would go through the mail every single day. Like we'd go to the mailboxes, just kind of part of your everyday. But nowadays with everything being so digital and online, sign me up for paperless. It's more of an every other week, like I check it and then you go through it. And I've noticed that too. And I don't know if it's because you and I had had a conversation about it, but I'm so now hyper aware of like the handwritten. Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of instances where that does stand out. It's harder to throw away something that someone spent time in. It's easier to throw away something that you get in the mail that is just kind of mass produced and not personal, right? Which, you know, brings us to our overarching topic of personalization. How important do you think, or what is the value of personalization for a brand to include that as part of their strategy? And how important is that personalization for the customer, do you think?
You know, the average consumer now, they're doing everything online, especially during COVID. And there's not that connection to a store clerk or a shop owner or restaurant owner or whatever. And at the same time, thanks to the internet, they have 1,000% transparency. So when they go to buy your thing or your service, whether it's a consumer or a business-to-business transaction, if they're a consumer, they can go to Yelp or Amazon and see 10,000 products with the same thing. Or if they're a business, they can go to G2 Crowd or Capterra or whatever and do the same thing. They have unlimited choice to find any sort of offer.
Yeah.
So when they choose to go with you, you better be grateful for it. You know, you have to show that appreciation that somebody's taken the time out of their schedule and their pocketbook or, you know, wallet to choose mm-hmm. you over everybody else out there. So sending a personalized note kind of pulls at their heartstrings a little bit. And it really, even if they know it's fake, like if you get the Christmas card from the president and you frame it like people do, you know, the president didn't sit down and write you a Christmas card, right? But it's still the same thing. It's just, gee, they took a second to do something different and that stands out and it shows they appreciate me and didn't cost you that much. You know, it's a couple bucks to do it, but I think it's really important for that personalization, just saying thank you. That's a personal thing to do. But then if you can throw a couple things in there, like thanks for your purchase of that leather backpack, or, you know, we're glad you got those dried pineapple snacks. We think you're going to like chocolate covered macadamia nuts. So you can do like cross-selling, cross-promotion within the notes and make it seem very personal there too. So we have clients doing that. We have clients just saying, hey, thanks so much for your purchase. Full stop. You know, not asking for anything. We have other ones that do cross promotions, some that do review requests. Yeah. If you liked it, go on Yelp. You know, we find just sending the note itself to be a personal act, even if the content inside of it isn't always 100% personal. The reason being perception of time taken to write that note and the focus it takes to write that note. Focus and time are a currency now.
Alexander Lowe has over 15 years of business development experience working within professional services. He has spent the last 4 years consulting back into the industry, helping business development and marketing teams, lawyers, attorneys, consultants, understand how to build social media and the behavior changes required into their go-to-market strategy. During our chat, we unpack the three pillars of social selling and learn great tips on how to find your audience reach on LinkedIn. Enjoy episode 30 with Alexandra Lowe.
What I like about what you said and what I really honed in on is that connect and pitch, because to me, it's very much so how we view influencer marketing. It's that connection part first, mm-hmm. then comes the pitch, right? That value of connecting with someone, I think, is really what you're really focused on when you're talking about, and I'm going to use the term whether you like it or not, social selling, because I think everybody understands or at least has an idea of what it is. And you've just broken it down. So what's an ideal then framework for social selling or executing what it is that you're describing?
So the fundamental pillars of social selling remain the same. And there are three of them. It's your personal brand, which I know some people kind of have an issue with, and it makes them feel a little bit icky, but it is fundamentally that first impression that you create in the digital space. It's a simple term. When was the last time you Googled yourself, and what comes up? What comes up on page two? Videos, images, documents associated with yourself. Of course, the main place people focus on is obviously LinkedIn. So that first digital impression that somebody makes of you, and I know that all you listeners do it, you look at someone's profile and you make a snap judgment based on what you can or cannot find, their profile photo, the crossover of the network that you may or may not have, whether they have shared any content or not. So with regards to that first impression, then it's around your network. So you need to think about your network and how can I activate my network. So a number of different things to consider. If you're not connecting to your clients, when it comes to you engaging with conversation, engaging with content on social, and this applies to all social channels, they're never going to see what you're doing. The second thing to give consideration of is that LinkedIn is not an address book. And a lot of people, when I work with them, they go, oh, I haven't really thought about it from that perspective because I feel connected to them because they're in my Outlook or my Gmail or I have them in, on my phone. So I didn't think I needed to connect with them on LinkedIn, but I hadn't considered the impact that that would have by not connecting with them. And then it's around your referral network. So your network of influence, if you will, which is your second degree. So I always encourage people to go into LinkedIn, type in your ideal customer persona, you know, CMO, CFO, CTO, what have you, then do second in the industry you want. That's your network of potential influence. And by that, I mean, A, how many introductions you can get straight out the gate, because an introduction or referral is the best way to start a sales conversation. But then secondly, what you want to give some consideration around on the network side of things is your network of influence needs to be pretty decent in the area that you want to be marketing or selling into. Because if it's not, when you come to the third aspect of social selling, which is content, which is the key piece in all of this, if you've got a small network of influence, you can't then activate that network through content. And the content piece is the hardest part for most people. What type of content do I create? What sort of content should I engage with? And it's all around blending it between the corporate message, if you will, through to this is me, this is what I stand for. This is a little bit of back to the personal brand, you know, personality behind the scenes, because people engage with humans, not companies.
Dan is the author of Winning at Social Customer Care, How Top Brands Create Engaging Experiences on Social Media, and a contributor of Forbes. Since launching and co-hosting the Experience This podcast, he is Brand 25 and BuzzSumo's top 100 digital marketers of 2019 and one of Fit Small Business's top customer services influencers. Dan just released his latest book, The Experience Maker, and chats with me about the importance of customer experience. This episode is packed with tips for everyone, and we really dive into increasing your customer lifetime value by creating remarkable experiences for your customer. And get his book, it's definitely a must read. But in the meantime, enjoy episode 31 with Dan Gingas.
I feel like there's such this correlation between what you discuss about customer experience and actually like almost influencer marketing, right? At Grin, we're always talking about creating authentic relationships with influencers to create great experiences, introduce them to your brand so that they love you. Because when they love you, it's like a great customer experience, right? Like they're going to talk about it and that's what you're always looking for. But as a marketer, I feel like there's a part of it that is on me, but is it on customer success? Is it on the sales team to create that customer experience?
Yes, yes, and yes. Okay. The reason is that customer experience really encompasses every single interaction that a customer has with your company. And frankly, that starts with marketing or sales. It's often the first time that we're exposed to a company. It might even be a television commercial is the first time we are made aware of a company. And that's when the experience begins. But then I really believe that everyone has a role in customer experience, even if you're not directly customer facing. I actually just wrote a blog post about this for one of my clients that everyone's in the business of customer service.
Yeah.
Even if you're in the finance department, if you're in the legal department, if you're in a back office role, chances are you're working on something that eventually the customer sees. So if you think about the finance department, not only are you working on some of the policies and pricing of your products, but you might also be the ones that send out invoices or that send out collection notices or whatever it is having to do with payment. And these are all experience points as well. If you work in the legal department, chances are you've got some sort of a contract or agreement that your customer signs, or you've got some disclosure language somewhere on your website. Yeah. These are all communication points where we can have an experience where one doesn't currently exist. So it is really important that culturally, everyone in the company feels like they have some impact on the customer experience.
Rui Perez is a brand strategist, best-selling author, keynote speaker, and CEO at Branding for the People. As a speaker, he brings actionable insights and practical tips for every audience. And during our chat, Rui not only defines what brand strategy is, it's more than just fonts and colors, my friends. He lays the hammer down with his point of view, saying, at the end of the day, I don't care if you are multinational B2B brand, a B2C brand, or personal brand. We all buy based on emotion, and then we validate our emotional buys through logic and reason. Enjoy episode 32 with Rui Perez.
One of the things that you said that I would love to just kind of double click on, because sure. You know, it evoked an emotion for me when you said it, was polarizing.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean by polarizing? Is there another brand example that comes to mind when you're thinking of like, all right, your brand should be polarizing? Because it feels so like, I don't want to say negative, but it definitely invoked something in me. When you said it, I was like, oh, I didn't think about it.
I like to think in terms of, there's like this bell curve that you can think of like this visual.
Yeah.
There's the 20-60-20 rule. Mm-hmm. And so what the 20-60-20 rule suggests is that there are 20% of the people who are going to be your raving fans. On the opposite side of that, there's 20% of the people who are going to be your naysayers. No matter what you do, they're yes. not going to say anything positive about your brand.
Okay.
And then there's the 60% who are sort of the followers. They can swing either way. Uh-huh. But if you focus enough on creating enough of the raving fans, if you focus on the 20%, that energetically can really help to pull people from that 60%. And so the reason I say polarizing is like, speak to the 20% of the people who are going to be raving fans and speak so loudly and unapologetically about who you are so that your naysayers are going to be very prominent as well. Uh-huh. And it's within that that you're going to pull people towards your brand because you have a strong point of view, a strong positioning. If you think about a classic example that most people will resonate with is, you know, Apple versus PC, right?
Yes.
Do you remember the ad campaigns when they said, I'm an Apple, I'm a PC?
Of course, of course.
So they've personified their brand through a type of person, a certain avatar. And ostensibly, you want to be able to look and be like, yes, I identify with that type of person. And no, I'm definitely not this type of person. So
you know, that's a classic example of creating some polarization.
Carla Johnson is a global keynote speaker and author. She believes that there is this stereotype that innovative thinking or innovation in general is time-consuming, expensive, and complex. But also knows that if you practice the characteristics of innovative thinking for just 10 or 15 minutes a day, it's amazing what can happen to you as a marketer or even as a team. During this episode, we really go down the rabbit hole of innovation, how it's not just for entrepreneurs of the company. It's on everyone to be innovative, and that sometimes it's not starting something from scratch. The old adage of why reinvent the wheel? It can mean just seeing something from a different angle and putting your brand twist on that ordinary idea to truly re-innovate. Enjoy episode 33 with Carla Johnson.
I want to kind of get down to the basics, because when I hear the word innovation, I come from the Silicon Valley. So it feels like innovation is that buzzword that everybody uses. But what does it actually mean? And more specifically, what's the role of innovation as it pertains to marketing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in Silicon Valley, there is more of a specific definition or expectation of innovation that is very product driven. It's very engineering driven. And what I want people to understand is that innovation is really everybody's business. It's not the research teams. It's not the product development teams. It's not, you know, the data analyst team. It's not the management consulting's team. Yeah. It's something that everybody has to identify with, own, and be willing to do. But when we think about that, that sounds like a big order, right? You know, especially if we look at some of these traditional definitions of innovation that is very product driven. And when I look at the companies and the people that have successfully delivered innovation over long periods of time, I find that they have a very simple approach to it. And they're very clear in defining it, because you can't expect people to do something unless they understand what it is. And I think that's particularly important for marketers. So I define innovation as the ability to consistently come up with new, great, and reliable ideas. Simple sentence, but some really important words in there. So first is a new idea. And for marketers, sometimes we think that a new idea has to be, you know, what? Never been done before, you know, out of this world kind of thing. And, you know, there's always that magic innovation word of disruption. Yeah. And it doesn't. I mean, for some companies, it just means that they took something that they saw in another industry and applied it in a new way in the work that they do. So I like to talk about the McDonald's drive-thru, because their inspiration for that came from a Formula One pit stop. Mm-hmm. Was it completely new? No. But had it ever been done in the, you know, fast food industry before? Also no. So it was a new idea. There's the great aspect of an idea. And I'll admit this is a little bit more subjective, but I go back to David Ogilvy when he says a great idea is one that makes you jealous that you didn't think of it yourself. You know, even when I talk about a great idea, see like the hair raising on my arm, you get excited and you can't wait to see what happens with it. But even an idea that's new isn't enough. An idea that's great, or even new and great, isn't enough. We have to have that third characteristic, and that's a reliable idea. And a reliable idea is an idea that makes you money.
Yeah.
One of the things that I hear that just drives me crazy is that people say ideas are the easy part. It's the execution that's really hard. And I believe that the execution is hard because it wasn't truly a great idea to start with. It didn't have all three of these characteristics. Now, the ability to consistently deliver ideas that are new, great, and reliable is what truly makes a person, a team, or a company innovative, because it's not about doing it once and going, you know, ta-da, there I did it, mic drop, and I'm done for the rest of my career. It's about the ability to consistently deliver, just like any great performer. You think about musicians, you think about athletes, it's the consistency in that high level of performance. It's the same with marketers and innovation.
Kurt started Convertica in 2016 after noticing a huge demand in the market after doing CRO on his own portfolio of websites. After 4 years, Convertica has worked with more than 650 businesses in countless verticals and monetization methods and run more than 7,000 split tests. During our chat, Kurt provided some helpful tips for how to improve website conversions, and how trust and credibility go a long way to increase those conversions. So placement of those trust signals is everything. He has his system down to a science and takes time to share some of those methods and theories in this episode. Enjoy episode 34 with Kurt Philip. Now, you know, you have mentioned that there are some best practices. You know, I went on your site and you have this really great blog that just kind of breaks down some CRO best practices. Mm-hmm. But if you had to pick, like, you know, top three best practices, mm-hmm. like if you're getting started and you want to test something out on your website, where do I get started? Is it with the trust signals at the top? Is it, you know, changing the wording, the color of a CTA button? Are mm-hmm. these things that are typically on your best practice list to just kind of figure out?
It depends on the type of website, but as a whole, trust and credibility are the main things. So okay. like a lot of people will have all the reviews on a reviews page.
Yeah.
But no one's going to go and like visit a reviews page. What you want to do is you want to have the reviews near the top in the top section, not on one of these carousels that shows one at a time. Like those are really annoying. You want to have like five or six all showing at the same time. With five star, what the review is, even if it's on Trustpilot or one of the credible platforms, like have it so it clicks over to that and they can see it's real, you know, so that it's further credible. Another one that worked really well for us at the start was to build credibility in an industry where no one knew who we were. We just went out and did free CRO on a lot of authorities' websites and in exchange for a blog post or a case study on their website, not on our website, but on their website, which further builds that credibility. And then that was a good way to do it too, which a lot of people do. So if you have a new product, go out and give the product away in exchange for a review, which is a bit of a gray area. I know on Amazon, they don't like people to do that. Yeah. But I mean, on scale, of course, and you need it to be natural. Like you need it to be like actually get the people to test it. You can get a video review even stronger again. So what you want to do is you want to make it so anytime someone looks for anything about you, you have positive feedback, sometimes critical feedback, but yeah, you don't really want like the one star, this is the worst company ever type of reviews because that's going to harm obviously a lot. But if you, yeah, like you want some stuff on YouTube, you want some two or three review platforms with good reviews on. I like to use Trustpilot because they have a good anti-spam filtering system. So they are expensive, but we've had a few of our competitors, I'm guessing, that just left one-star review and just said, this is the worst company ever, don't work with them, beware, whatever. And then we triggered it, flagged it as a, reported it as fake, and then they had to show proof they work with us, whether it's emails, receipt, anything like that, and they couldn't, so it got taken down. Whereas I know people are struggling with Google reviews a lot of the time to have that done because it's Google. They don't really care so much as Trustpilot, which it's their main product. So, reviews and trust and credibility are probably the biggest for any website when you're starting out, especially.
It was fun reliving the best moments of my many conversations over the course of the year. We have so much more in store for this next year with new episodes for season 2 beginning November 3rd. We've got a star-studded lineup this season and I can't wait for you to come along for the ride. A big thank you to all who have subscribed, dropped a rating, and left us a review. Share the podcast with your friends, family, customers, neighbors, really anyone. If you have suggestions or just want to say hi, please feel free to reach out to me directly at katya@grin.co. Let me spell it out for you. Katya, K-A-T-Y-A at grin.co, grin.co, with the subject line of Katya, I'm listening. If you haven't subscribed, what are you waiting for? Season 2 starts November 3rd with new episodes dropping every other Wednesday. So until next time, keep grinning.